Stephen Heller's arrangement of Schubert's song The Trout isn't a pushover, but the performer, Frank Glaser, has had plenty of time to work on it. He's celebrating 90 years at the keyboard. What's the secret to his long life as a musician? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
He took his first piano lessons from his sister sometime before 1920, took lessons from several Milwaukee-area musicians, and in the early 30s played in his brother's dance band. And then a patron made it possible for him to go to Berlin, where he studied piano with the celebrated Arthur Schnabel, and he also worked with the influential composer Arnold Schoenberg. What was it like to be in Berlin in the 30s, and how did his service in World War II affect his career? How did his study of anatomy change his approach to playing the piano? From 1965 till 1980, Frank Glaser taught at the Eastman School of Music. In the 1970s, he and his wife Ruth founded a summer chamber music series, the Saco River Festival in Maine, and he went on to become artist-in-residence at Bates College in Maine and is still an active concertizer.
Oh, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What an amazing career you've had.
I've done a lot of different things somehow.
You have. I read in something that you wrote that one of your piano teachers hit you on the head or, you know.
With his hard knuckles.
Yeah.
Back of the head.
So
for about 4 years that went on. I'm surprised I'd never rebelled or never thought of it. I did follow my mother around the house one day when she was sweeping the floor. And I said, here in the Etude magazine, there's a teacher's column that says the teacher shouldn't hit the pupil. And as I recall, my mother said, while she's nonchalantly sweeping, well, maybe you learn better that way. And I thought, well, maybe mother knows best. I don't know. But I never said I'm going to quit because he's doing that. And I put up with it summers as well because I never had any vacation from that. Only vacation from that once a year at Christmas time. We gave him a box of candies. And things were more
amiable.
But the thing I'm grateful to him for is that he taught me nothing.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, because often teachers teach you things you have to unlearn. And I didn't have to unlearn anything. The lesson consisted of his sitting at the upright piano we had, playing the new piece he assigned to me. I sat at his left, looked at the music, and by osmosis, I was supposed to be able to play it perfectly next week. And if I made a mistake,
pal.
And of course, the most humiliating part of that was that my brothers used to get their friends and gather on the porch, look through the window, and watch him, quote, get it.
So you were an entertainer from the get-go.
Well, if you go back, you were born in 1915.
Yes.
When did you know that music was going to be your life?
Maybe when I was in my mid-teens. And I didn't know it because I knew it. It's because my teacher knew it. I never thought, oh, I want to be a concert pianist. But my teachers encouraged me and asked me to play here. And in junior high school, I was asked to play in the assembly program many weeks, one piece at a time. In high school, the same thing. And when I graduated from Roosevelt Junior High in Milwaukee, I played the Mendelssohn G minor piano concerto, the whole thing, with our school orchestra. And when I was in high school, at graduation, I played with our North Division High School Orchestra. The first movement, Anton Rubinstein's concerto in D minor that Joseph Hoffmann had played a lot.
Oh, that sounds fiendishly difficult.
And when I was 17, a senior in high school, I played with a Young People's Symphony at the Milwaukee Auditorium, conducted by Milton Rush, who taught me composition also, harmony theory, counterpoint and all that. We did the Moskowski Concerto. And when I was still a senior in high school, because I went to school only in the mornings, I was able to play at the Alhambra Theater, the Rhapsody in Blue, 4 shows a day for a whole week, 28 performances in a week, with the orchestra in the pit, you see. And guess who sat right next to me? Liberace's father, Sam.
No kidding.
Whom he didn't like. But he was a kid then. He was maybe 10 years old at the time, and I didn't know.
Liberace was.
Yeah, right. Father Sam played the horn right next to me.
I gather Liberace didn't necessarily learn a lot from you then.
No, nothing from me. I met him once at the Palace Theater in New York many years later because his manager had the same doctor that we had. And the manager gave our doctor tickets to hear Liberace at the Palace Theater, and so our doctor invited my wife and me. And there we went backstage to meet him.
What did you think of his playing?
Well, he's very gifted, obviously, had great fluency. I like the way he said he played only the inspiration of the composers and not the work. And he had his place. When I came back from the war, my cousin in Milwaukee said, when I visited my family, because I wasn't living in Milwaukee then, living in California and then New York, he said, you know, there's a young fellow here who's now playing in lounges, pop music. He said, you've played in vaudeville and you could do that. Why didn't you earn a lot of money? That was Liberace, getting started, you know. I said, no, I'm not going to change from what I've been doing. That's not my cup of tea. Although I played in vaudeville for 3 years and a half, probably.
Well, it was Liberace who was famous for flashing his diamond rings before his audience.
All the way to the bank.
You like my rings? I hope so, because you paid for them.
Oh, yeah. I got to hand it to him. He made it work.
He entertained
people, made them happy, you know.
You didn't have any gimmicks yourself?
No, not one, not even one, unless I didn't know it, unless I wasn't aware of what I was doing.
Well, there were pianists back then, though, if we're talking about the 20s and 30s, and still somewhat today, I suppose, who would put a lot of extra body motion, a lot of flamboyance into
only,
the appearance.
Only one was famous for that, and not so much the flamboyance as doing odd things like stopping or playing a trill and then stopping. It wasn't that a beautiful trill. That was de Pachman, who was famous for that.
Was he? Vladimir de Pachman.
Yeah, he'd get up from the piano in a concert after playing, walk around the piano, circle back. And I don't know what he's trying to prove with that. No, but otherwise, I've heard most of the great people, like Joseph Hoffman, Rachmaninoff. Paderewski stomped his foot on the pedal when he played the Second Hungarian Rhapsody. But otherwise, they just sat there quietly and played, and you got the music. This thing about the physical gyrations is, I think, very distracting, and it came about as more and more people began to think they had to be involved in showbiz in order to be successful. You see, they would do anything to be successful, and I never would do anything to be successful. I tried to do it because it was right. So, you know, my teacher, Arthur Schnabel, gave 3 lectures at the University of Chicago that he called Music in the Path of Most Resistance. Well, I believed in that myself, too. So I never took the easy way, but I tried to do it the right way. One example of that would be that if I had an idea for a program and I was missing one piece because of timing, I needed to make it longer or whatever, I had to have the right piece to fit there. Now, I could have said to myself, well, I know so many pieces, I'll just stick this one in there, that's the time. But if I didn't think it was the right piece in the right place, I wouldn't do it. I'd learn a new piece, make it harder on myself to do it. But it had to be right, you see. And I never settled for expediency either. And I'm glad because now at my age, I'm glad that I never compromised, though I was sometimes seduced into being compromised musically. But that's when I learned really the truth of being true to yourself, as Polonius told Laertes.
What experience in Berlin did you have? How did going there shape
Well, I went there at a terrible time politically, where the communists and the Nazis were at loggerheads and shooting each other, and big parades of the communists and down the Kurfürstendamm in Charlottenburg, a suburb of Berlin, in which the leader would shout, "We have," and the crowd would yell, "Hunger, hunger." And then he'd say, "With fascism," they'd say, "Down, down." I heard somebody actually shot. I saw a Nazi go into a building around 11 o'clock at night. There was a shot. He came out to the car, which had the engine still running with somebody at the wheel, and took off. Culturally, what was curious is that although it was awful politically, culturally it was a great city. They had at least three great orchestras, 3 opera houses, museums, theater was thriving, and everything was very vibrant. But the political situation was terrible. And also, the economic situation was terrible. Of course, I'm talking about, I got there in October 1932 when von Papen was a chancellor. And then von Schleicher came in, and Hitler came in January, a few months after I got there. And although I was going to stay there 2 years to work with Schnabel, in May of that year, 33, after my being there only 8 months, he decided to leave because it was getting too dangerous. He was afraid his apartment would be ransacked and all, as they were doing, the stormtroopers there. And so he went to Lake Como in Italy, and I followed him there. And I finished the year there with him. And then later I went back to study with him in Italy and in New York also.
Did you study a lot of Beethoven in which novel? He's so famous for those Beethoven recordings.
Yeah, that's a good question because I studied only one Beethoven sonata with him.
Really?
Yeah. I just now played all 32 for the first time in my life in one season at Bates College from last September to this past May.
You playing those from memory?
No, I didn't. I did
can't
most
blame
of them. Well, I could, most of them. But no, ever since my quadruple heart bypass 9 years ago, right here in Milwaukee, because I happened to be playing at Carroll College in Waukesha with the New England Piano Quartet, I had this quadruple heart bypass at Columbia Hospital. And they did such a wonderful job that 9 years later, I'm still able to play today.
All those 32 Beethoven piano sonatas.
Yeah, right.
That's amazing.
And I'd never played all 32 before. I let everybody else do it. And I thought, now my time has come. I've got to do it. I had never played Hammerklavier before at all.
Oh, it's a big one.
I taught it only once to a student. And from September until March, when I did play it, it was a big cloud over my head while I was learning the others and reviewing others and playing other programs along the way, whether I could be ready in time. And I was doing them chronologically so that, being a college-based college, it would be interesting to try to understand his evolution as a composer through doing them chronologically. But if I had not been ready and had to postpone it, it would have been out of the chronology. Or if I'd gotten sick, as I always did once a year anyway with a cold or pneumonia or something, then I wouldn't be able to do it chronologically. So that weighed over me until I actually did it. And when I did it, I sailed through it as though I'd known it all my life. I felt very close to Beethoven. So when I went through all these 32, I felt as though I was walking side by side with him, very peaceful. I knew how difficult some of the things were and was concerned about how it might go in that one performance. But it always went well. I remembered what Schnabel had said at a lesson when I was playing the Brahms B-flat concerto. When the going gets difficult, sit back and relax. Instead of getting more and more tense, you know this is coming. Mm-hmm. Tell you, sit back and relax, and it'll be much easier. And it's true, it does. It worked.
Now, you've studied a lot about the anatomy of piano playing, the method, which must have something to do with why at 95 you're still able to play without
I think
difficulty.
It does, because I discovered some things that I was never taught. After I played with the Boston Symphony, for a reason I won't go into now, I decided that I'm going to start from scratch to learn how to play the piano as though I knew nothing about it when I started. If I was, say, 12 years old and I want to learn to play and have no teacher, how shall I play? Well, common sense told me that you should play in the most efficient way. That's the one thing I learned in high school physics, not division high. Efficiency. Don't do anything that you don't need to do, but the corollary is anything you have to do, you should do. So you can't just say relax. You'd fall off the chair if you relaxed. So it was a question of learning which muscles to tense and which you could relax when you were needing to tense those that were needed to accomplish the artistic end you had in mind. At first, I didn't even know to ask myself the first question, how shall I play? My piano teacher told me when I was 12 years old that Leschetizky had said, the famous teacher in Vienna, that you should hold your hand as though there's a ball in the hand. Well, when you're 12 years old, you don't question your teacher. And anyway, the famous Leschetizky said so. But now that I was thinking about it, should it be with a high wrist, a low wrist? Should the knuckles be caved in like that, like I heard some pianists played? And how do you know one way is better than another? And the first question I asked myself was, well, if you hold your hand somewhat, you have to be able to cross the thumb under the hand to play more than five fingers.
So that high.
Yeah, that's how that goes. So you can't play with on the fingertip because you'd come on your thumb, you see. So I thought, well, it looks as though there's an arch in the fingers. And who knows about arches? Well, the Romans, of course, with their aqueducts. But go find a Roman now. So I thought, well, the next best person would be a civil engineer.
Right.
And where I was living at the time, at Dana Point in California, just 7 miles south of Laguna Beach, there were only three houses on the Dana Point at the time. Now there are over 100, I think. Anyway, there was a civil engineer, retired. And I thought, I'll go ask him. But then I said to myself, if I ask him and he tells me, how is that going to help me? I don't know how that will help me. So I never did ask him. That's how hard it was to find the first question even, mind you. Well, then I finally figured it out in a way that proves Leschetizky to be correct, but not sufficient in his explanation, because I found a natural answer for that. And I suppose not time to go into it because one should demonstrate it. But when you hold your arm at your side, that your fingers are curved that way. And so if you bring them up here, they're curved that way. And I didn't do anything to curve them. If I were going to move them out, straighten them out, then I'm using the flexor muscles here to straighten them. And anyway, I don't want to work more than I have to, you see, to accomplish what I want to. That's always the basic thing. And so the next step was anything that works is useful. But if it can work easier, that's better.
Well, that's after all, you're in this for a long time.
Well, and, it's because I figured it out. I figured it out. And that's what I think makes it possible. Because I have taught somebody who was a very well-known accompanist, played for Misha Elman, Gladys Wertheim, James Milton, and the great baritone John Charles Thomas.
Oh, John Charles Thomas.
In the 60s, yeah, he called me up in New York, said, Frank, I'd like to come see you. I said, what do you want to see me about, Carol? He said, I want to have some lessons with you. I said, are you out of your mind? He had a big international career. He said, I've gotten to a point, Frank, I can't play anymore. I'm so tense, I don't know the way out. I said, well, if that's it, I can show you the way out. And I did. And then later, when he performed again with his wife, who was a singer, and had a party, and I entered, he introduced me as the person who saved his life pianistically. So that is to show you that it can get that bad that you can't even play.
We hear a lot of stories, don't we, about pianists who, for one reason or another, tense up.
So it's a matter of knowing how to use the playing mechanism from the fingertip to the shoulder. Now, some people will tell you you have to play with your back. Well, the piano is here, the key, the action is here, where your finger's going to touch it. Your back is leaning against that key to push it down. Of course, you use your back to sit up, so it's part of it. But you play with your finger and your arm and your wrist and all that. Well, it's a complex thing, and figuring it out took about 2 years. I read not only that, that was the first step, reading, studying Gray's Anatomy from the fingertip to the shoulder, to see if I could do it with one muscle or did I need three or two. If I could do it with one, then I'm not going to use the other two.
How many did you need?
Well, I don't know because it's so complex that even a distinguished physiologist at Rochester University, whose name was Wallace Fenn, couldn't tell me. I said to him, it was an interdisciplinary dinner party at the university. So doctors were there, musicians and English professors. And I said, now's my chance to find this out. I knew that when I raised my arm, I used the biceps. But if you can use another muscle, if you're lifting a pail of water, the biceps may not be enough. And then you have to use the they used to call it the brachioradialis. No, the brachialis anticus. Now in Grant's Atlas of Anatomy, they call it the brachioradialis. Well, anyway, so I asked the physiologist this. And I thought he'd tell me. He said, that's an anatomical question. You know, you musicians are doing it all the time. You know more about it than we do. Ask Dr. Cy Schwartz over there. He's a surgeon. So I asked Cy Schwartz, and he told me. And then I knew that much. But it didn't matter whether I knew it or not, as long as I used it correctly, you see. But I'll give you one simple example. A child, and often adults too, will take a pencil and they'll squeeze it very hard to hold it, and then they bear down to write and break a point because they think they need to do that. And if you say to that person, you don't have to hold it so tight, they hold it looser. Then they'll do it and it falls out of their hand. They say, see, I told you I had to hold it tight. No, you didn't. You needed to use your muscles only enough to hold it at all. But don't squeeze it where you're using excessive tension, which is going to give you tendonitis somewhere eventually, and that sort of thing. It's by overdoing, you see, by having overkill that people go wrong. They work too hard, and they don't know how to do nothing. It's a very important lesson, I think, in life, to learn how to do nothing. That's when something can get done. Oddly enough, it sounds a paradox, but it's true. And so most people who get into trouble physically do so because they don't succeed with the way they try. They think they must try harder, and so they get more tense. And then they must still don't succeed. They try still harder.
Sure.
And they get to the point which a woman came to in New York when she came to me and said, Mr. Glaser, I used to be able to play fast. Now I can't play fast anymore. Could you tell me what's wrong? I said, let me see you play. In 2 minutes, I said, well, your problem, you've got overkill. You're working too hard. I said, you know, I read in the New York Times just recently, some years ago, that Lake Champlain was polluted, that the way to cure the pollution is not to put some chemical in, just don't pollute it anymore, and nature will cure it. And that's what you've got to do. I said, I know why you got so tense, because you didn't succeed when you first tried, and you thought you're not working hard enough. And working hard enough is going in the wrong direction. Just like if you try to make Schubert sound like Beethoven, you're going in the wrong direction.
Well, let's hear something that actually is, I think, going to sound pretty relaxed, but obviously takes a lot of technique. There's a little piece by Grieg that one doesn't hear too often anymore. And this is our guest today, Frank Laser, with Papillon.
Was The Butterfly by Grieg, played by our guest Frank Glazer. More in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest, pianist Frank Glazer, who has been performing now for about 90 years and is still concertizing widely and recording. And part of his longevity, one is tempted to attribute to the study of anatomy and the most efficient way to actually make music out of a piano. You studied Gray's anatomy. You studied some of the successors to that. How far did you go with that?
Well, I studied Otto Ortmann's book on the physical basis of piano touch and tone, in which he had many diagrams of the sound you got when you played with curved fingers or flat fingers. And I learned a lot about the instrument. But that made me realize that if I would live through the war in which I knew I'd be inducted, then I was going to go to a piano technology school to study the instrument as a machine to know when it's its fault and when it's my fault. And if it's its fault, I'm not going to beat my head against a brick wall. And so I went to Steinway's after the war, and they said, we in Baldwin support the New York Trade School Piano Crafts Department. And I applied there, and I became a certified piano technician. And I did it professionally for many years to get better at it. And I actually, one of the bonuses for me was that when I played a recital at Carnegie Hall, one of the concerts was within a two-week period when the tuners were on strike in New York.
So you had it covered.
I had to do it myself or play on an untuned piano or cancel the concert. That was the choice given me by Steinway.
That has to be very unusual, isn't it, for a performer, for a pianist to be also a piano technician?
Well, I was the first one who did it in Carnegie Hall, I know that. But as I say, I didn't do it as a gimmick. I did it because it was better than losing all the investment I already put in rental on the hall that everybody has to pay and managerial fees and so on. And nobody complained that the piano wasn't in tune. It was not easy to do because I was playing a very difficult program, and I went to Steinway's the day before to check on the piano that I was going to use, tune it, and there were some false waves in the beginning of the Brahms B minor Rhapsody, you hear a wah, wah, wah kind of guy to try to get rid of. And then they moved the piano to Carnegie Hall a block away, and I tuned it there that morning instead of practicing this program I should have. And then that evening, I put on my coat over my full dress, tails and all that, to check unisons, but didn't want the people to know that I was the one who's going to be playing. And so it came in very handy, I must say. But I learned, therefore, how the piano worked as a machine, and then relationships between the anatomy, the human anatomy, and the instrument. But also, I studied Matthias Alexander's books on the use of the self, which is the principal one. And then he wrote three others, and I read all of them around 1940 when I was 41, when I was looking into this situation. At that time, Alexander was derided by people in the music world, thinking that's like, you know, it's not scientific and you can't prove anything and all that. Now they engage people who specialize in to teach at Eastman School, at the Peabody School, Juilliard, and have them come for 2 weeks or a month so that they won't get into habits that'll give them trouble. And so Alexander talks about also how to change a bad habit into a better habit. That was very helpful. And beyond that, I discovered two things for myself which, had I not discovered all of them, I'm telling you now, wouldn't have helped. One was an objective test for knowing when I was playing with the weight of the arm on the keyboard that teachers talk a lot about, but I wonder if they know, really, that the student is using weight when they tell them, because they get a sound that sounds like it, and teachers say, oh, that's better. But you can get that sound through different means. The other thing was an objective, I did say the objective test for knowing if I'm playing with weight or not, and the other was the norm for how to hold the hands on the keys. So that has helped me tremendously. And adding it all together, the picture finally came to me as to how to play, whereby I don't ever feel tired. People say to me after a rigorous program, don't your fingers feel tired? I don't feel. Mm-hmm. I feel less tired after every piece because then I know I don't have that much as far to go.
I have a question for you. You know the piano teacher that used to hit you on the head when you made mistakes?
Uh-huh.
Did he live long enough to know you were going to be such a success?
No, no. He had
a shame.
No. He had, but he did one thing, and to this day I wonder why he did it. One day when I was 11 years old, he came to our house for a lesson, and he said to my mother, now you must take the boy to hear the great pianists when they come to Milwaukee, and the next one will be Paderewski. Whether he did that with all his students or just with me, I don't know. But my mother did take me, and I, at 11 years old, heard the first piano concert music I'd heard. It was all Chopin program, and I reproduced that program myself at Bates College many, many years later, every piece. So I know that the first concert piece I heard of piano music was the Chopin Fantasy in F minor.
Sure.
And Paderewski had everything in the kitchen sink in that program because, you know, they played long programs because they came every other year or something and they didn't have all this on the radio, all the music we have now and so on.
Now, your brothers, I mentioned at the beginning, had a band that you played in. This would have been, I guess, in the early 30s. One of them, though, at least, became a clarinetist, a classical clarinetist.
Yeah.
In fact, we even have a performance that features both of you.
He became world-renowned. He played with a lot of famous singers. He played in the Cleveland Symphony for 5 years. That's George Sell hired him to do. But he got bored with symphony playing, wanted to play chamber music after 5 years. So he quit and he joined the New York Woodwind Quintet, with which he stayed for 34 years. And he and I played quite a lot, the clarinet repertoire and woodwind music. And we also had a team in which a violinist who played viola also, and he on the clarinet and I piano, played that repertoire. Bartok Contrast, for example, Mio Serenade, I think it was called. And also with my wife, who was a singer, you know, we did Spohr songs for clarinet,
sure,
voice,
yes,
and piano, and The Shepherd on the Rock of Schubert, and other repertoire we could do. And so I had a very, very rich musical life, though, growing up as a kid even, because we had a cousin who was older, a little older, played at the Alhambra Theater, violin in the orchestra. And he'd come to our house when I was 9, 10, and 11, and he'd bring books of overtures, Morning, Noon, and Night in Vienna, Light Cavalry,
yeah,
Orpheus in the Underworld, Tales of Vienna Woods, which I loved then, even more than the Blue Danube.
It's maybe the best of all the Strauss's.
Yeah, it was really
wonderful. It was Strauss's favorite, too.
Was it really?
Yes, it was.
I didn't know that.
Because it harked back to his boyhood than any of the others.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm interested to hear that because I really loved that piece as a kid even.
But what a rich family life it sounds like you had with
when
music.
When the relatives came, we all played together. We had an odd assortment of instruments. There was a clarinet and trumpet and drums and piano and violin. And, you know, our ordinary arrangement of these things. But it was fun, and And so we had music going in the house all the time.
Maybe we could listen to a piece that has you and your brother in it.
This is one of the movements from the Sextet for Piano and Winds of Francis Poulenc. It features the New York Woodwind Quintet, among whom is clarinetist David Glazer, and the pianist for the occasion, our guest today, Frank Glazer.
Thank you.
That's a movement from Francis Poulenc's Sextet for Piano and Winds, featuring the New York Woodwind Quintet, that included clarinetist David Glazer and his brother, our guest today, Frank Glazer, as the pianist. And the sound from, well, 50 years ago now, that's a lot of playing you've been doing since that recording came out.
Right.
You have this entire CD. We don't have all of your discs, but there's one that's devoted to these, what would you say, not musty old pieces exactly, but pieces that haven't been heard many of them for a long time.
Some people call it grandmother's piano bench music.
And there's a lot of worthy music in those old pieces. There's one on there by Lyotov that has a particular charm to it.
Yeah.
You're talking about the just music of a bygone era.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Little pieces, sort of piano novelties. Is that how you would describe them?
Well, they were famous in their day, beautifully written for the piano.
Sort of color pieces.
But they didn't stand the test of time to be compared with Chopin, Bach, and all that. So they got to be known as salon music. A little bit of denigration there. But still, beautifully written for the piano, and they were famous in their day, played by great pianists, actually. And, my teacher, Milwaukee, knew all that repertoire, so he gave it to me. But I have not played much of that in concert either. But I did first played them, and I called it A Sentimental Musical Journey. And I did three concerts of it. This CD represents only a small part of the total amount I played in those kinds of pieces, including the Blue Danube Waltz by Schultz Eveler, transcription of the Strauss piece, and so many pieces that we don't hear anymore in public.
Can you tell us about the one called Musical Snuffbox? Tell us about that piece.
Well, when I was young, people used snuff boxes. They put fingers in the snuff box and put it to their nose. It gave some kind of a kick or a high, or whatever they called it in those days. And usually it was elderly men who did that. And in Russia, certainly. Where else? Maybe in Balkan countries, but maybe in the Near East also. I'm not sure.
Very popular as gifts, too, weren't they? Fancy snuff boxes.
Oh, yes. Right. And so I don't know how Lyotov got the idea to call it a musical snuff box, but it's like a music box, in other words. And for him, it was a snuff box. For somebody else would have another name for a music box, you see. This happens to have a very particular charm. I think it's a gem for what it is. But my teacher gave me a lot of that music because he had studied in Vienna, and it was popular then between 1890 and 1900. And when recently I was in Vienna to play, and I showed that repertoire that I sent to Schnabel to ask him if he would take me, I sent a list of all the pieces I had played between ages 12 and 17. And when I showed it to this musicologist, who just wrote a book on Strindberg, by the way, he said, this is the perfect Vienna repertoire. See, my teacher, when he came to Milwaukee, stayed in that era.
Sure.
Where Schnabel moved on, you see, living in Vienna, then moved to Berlin and so on. And so I was, let's say, privy to and lucky in a way to have heard this and learned this repertoire, because it is really wonderful and is not played much anymore.
On the Musical Snuff Box. Thank you. There's your musical snuffbox by Anatoly Yadov and played by our guest, Frank Glaser, with whom more, especially, we'll find out about his experience with Arnold Schoenberg when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Frank Glaser is an excellent musician and a pianist of high qualities. The best test for his great talent, for me, was his fine interpretation of the Schubert Sonata, A minor, Opus 42, which is a very difficult work to perform. I am sure he will make his way in the concert halls of the world. That's a comment by Kurt Weill in 1936 at a debut concert of our guest today, Frank Glaser, who is now 95 and still playing piano and sharing with us many of his recordings. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. We haven't talked about your encounter with the famous composer Schoenberg.
Schoenberg, yes. Well, I was studying harmony, theory, counterpoint, composition with Milton Rush in Milwaukee as a high school student, junior high and high school student. I had private lessons with him. Every week I had to turn in an assignment. And he said, well, since you're going to Berlin to study with Schnabel, why don't you see Schoenberg there? He's the big man at the academy. And he had himself studied with Schoenberg in Vienna in 1926 for 6 weeks. And so that was the connection in a way. And when I got to Berlin, I was able to tell Schoenberg that I had heard Toscanini conduct Schoenberg's transcription of Bach's St. Anne's Fugue for the orchestra. And I also brought along his second edition of the Harmonielehre, his book on harmony. And he asked me how much I paid for it. I said, $9.25. He said, I only get about $2 from that. And he said, why did you come to Berlin? I said, I came to study with Schnabel. Has he heard you play yet? I said, no. How do you know he'll take you? I said, because I don't think he'll send me home now when he said I should come. So he said, do you know how much Schnabel charges for a lesson? I said, yes, 100 marks, which was then $25 and soon became $40 because of the devaluation of the dollar. And he said, I charge 100 marks too. And well, he didn't to Germans who couldn't afford it, because Beethoven, American, he thought everybody had a lot of money. And I said, well, these men who sent me to study Schnabel don't know about my interest in composition, so I have no budget for it at all, and I just couldn't afford that. He said, well, then you could study with an assistant of mine, a former student, and I'll check your work twice a month. So I said I would think about it. Well, meanwhile, I had brought what art students call a portfolio. I had written a fugue and a gavotte for a piano and four songs that were exercised in song form, but they've all been published by BMI. I did as soon as I graduated from high school. And he looked over my shoulder and he said, well, you have a real aptitude for counterpoint. And I said, well, I would like to study, but I don't know if I can. So anyway, oh, also, you know, in his system of 12-tone composition, the idea was of the 12 tones we have, you could have one melody made out of four notes and the other melody made out of the other eight notes, but you mustn't repeat any one till you went through the whole row. It could be a row horizontal or a row in a chord vertical, but you had to go through the whole thing. And Milton Rush, before I went abroad, showed me Schoenberg's first complete 12-tone composition, which is a waltz in his Opus 23, I think it is, the last piece. And there, one row was in blue pencil, the other was in red pencil, that my teacher had written out. And every once in a while, there was a note missing in the tone row with a question mark. And so I bought a copy, and I copied my teacher's notation in there in my copy. And I thought, oh, now I'm going to see Schoenberg. I'll ask him, why did he leave out those notes? Because it seems arbitrary. If the rule was so strict, you had to have every note, could you leave out some? So I sat at his upright piano. He looked over my shoulder. And when I said, why did you do this? He said, well, that was so long ago, I forget. It was only 9 years. He didn't forget. Later, I discovered, I think he said so himself, that he, in a way, he was able to rise above the limitations of a theorist when it came to being the artist as a composer, that he was not slavishly bound to even his own theory.
Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
It was a great thing, yes.
Not to be rigid.
Yeah, not to be that rigid. That was his explanation to the world at some point that I read. And, of course, it makes a lot of sense. But then he said to me, it was so long ago, I forget why I did it. He didn't tell me the answer that he gave later, you see. But then I thought about it. And, well, Leonard Schur was a pupil of Schnabel before me. And because I didn't know a soul when I came to all of Germany, and not a person in the whole country. Snobber called Leonard Shore, who had studied with him, who had come from Chicago, and I from Oregon, and he thought he'd be big brother for me, get me a place to live with a piano and look after me, and so on. And he did. Well, Leonard Shore said to me, well, what are you going to do? You're going to study with Schoenberg and piano? Well, you're crazy. You're 17 years old. You've got to grow. You're in the world capital now. You've got to go to theater, the opera concerts, and you know what are you going to do? I said, well, I'll practice 4 hours a day, and I'll do composition 5 hours a day. Well, you're crazy. He said, you got to grow up. Because I was green as could be. So he talked me out of it in a way. But then when I came back to the States, I was going to stay 2 years, but I stayed only 1 year because of Hitler. And I came to Milwaukee to visit my family for a month before going to Cambridge to see Leonard Shore there. He said, I'll get you students and have you meet people. That was when I was spending the summer with Schnabel, and he went from Berlin to Cambridge, to Boston, really. When I was home, I read in the Milwaukee Journal that the Malkin brothers, Joseph and Nikolai Malkin, had a music school in Boston, and they were bringing Schoenberg over to teach in their school. I thought, oh, now I'm going to nab him. This time I will. And so I called him up when I got to Cambridge, and I told him I'd like to study with him. And then he charged $15 a lesson, and I had 2 lessons a week. But not for very long, because of 2 things. I was working so hard. I was taking courses at the Harvard Extension Division, the history of Florentine painting and current philosophical tendencies. I was teaching piano about 10 hours a week, and I was taking piano lessons, practicing 4 hours a day, and going to Boston Symphony every Friday afternoon, all that kind of thing. So I was beginning to have a nervous breakdown, though I didn't recognize it. I said to the landlady at whose home I lived, I was 18 at the time, you know, my coat is feeling very heavy as I walk up these little inclines now, Cambridge, and I don't know why they should be heavier now than they were before. She said, Frank, I think you're heading for trouble. You ought to give up some of the things you're doing. So I realized I had to stop that. I was up till 1 in the morning doing 16th century counterpoint. I got to the point where I could write fugue for him also. And then also he went to Hollywood.
Yes,
so
he
I
did.
Would have lost him anyway.
Yes.
But he had lost everything when he left Germany. He was kicked out of the academy by the Nazis, for
yes.
one thing. He had been top, and now he was nothing. And I could describe him as a person whose face was so serious that if he smiled, it would crack. He was so sober. And once at a lesson, I came in, and he was very nervous and pacing up and down his apartment in Brookline. And he said he was going to conduct his 6 pieces or 5 pieces for orchestra, Opus 16. And so difficult. And I thought, and he kept saying it over and over, he's walking back and forth. And I'm sitting there listening to this, and I thought, I'm called upon to say something. I've learned since then to keep my mouth shut and let it work its way out without my commenting on it. So I said to him, naively, well, if it's so hard, why did you write it that way? You wrote it.
An honest question.
Yeah, you know?
Just not well
timed. Fortunately, I think he was so engrossed in his own thoughts and worried about it, I don't think he heard me. I hope not, anyway. So anyway, it was a wonderful experience I had knowing him. And he was a great master of classical, the really Baroque counterpoint. Boy, he could spot a mistake like an eagle right off and correct it. But he then had a baby daughter who married, I think it was Berio, Luciano Berio, later. She was about 2 years old at the time that I saw
her. Another cutting-edge composer.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's close this wonderful hour by hearing more of your piano playing.
We'll go full cycle here. We heard at the beginning of the conversation that Heller fantasy on the Trauta. Here it is in its original instrumentation by Franz Schubert. And this is just a bit of the most famous part, the theme and variations of the Trout Quintet. In a performance that features our guest today, Frank Glaser, with double bassist Harold Siegel and members of the Fine Arts Quartet.
Thank you.
Frank Glaser was the pianist there with the Chicago Fine Arts Quartet, and we heard also bassist Harold Siegel in that excerpt from the Trout Quintet by Franz Schubert. A pleasure having you with us for this conversation.
Thank you. I've enjoyed being here,
Look forward to more concerts and more recordings.
Well, thank you, sir.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Charles Cohen will be our guest, and with him we'll be looking at that great American tradition, Thanksgiving, through the centuries, how it's changed. You might be in for some surprises. Right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.